Okay. Thank you, everybody. Welcome. Good evening. This is the Simple Action Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Larry, and I'm an alcoholic. People are probably wondering, I just pressed the record button. We're only recording the audio portion of this meeting that will be published at a later time on simpleactions.net. Also, during the meeting, so there'll be a time for questions and answers. So get your questions ready when you think about them. We'll talk more about that in a second. For those who would like to join us, help me in opening this meeting with the Serenity Prayer.
God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Action Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to everyone in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We'd simply like to say hello and welcome you. Feel free to unmute, wave your hand. I'm looking around. Anybody in their first 30 days? I don't see any hands. Awesome. Okay. Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of
Hey, Larry, Ashley M. raised her hand.
I got muted somehow. All right, I'm unmuted. Thanks for pointing that out. Ashley, did you want to say hi? Let's see.
Yeah, hey guys, I'm Ashley. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ashley. Are you in your first 30 days, Ashley?
Yeah, I'm on day one right now.
Awesome, that's great. If you're keeping on the chat, I'm sure there'll be plenty of people. I'll leave the chat open for a little bit. So if people would like to post their numbers for Ashley, I'm sure she'd appreciate that. Welcome,
Thank
Ashley.
You.
We're glad you're here. Okay. Once again, the format of this meeting, it's a speaker slash ask it basket. Our speaker will share their experience, strength, and hope for about an hour. Then we'll have a short break. We'll do some housekeeping. And then we'll take some questions and answers during the meeting. If you're thinking of questions, send them to me. We need your questions for the second half of the meeting. So send them over to me and I'll put them all together and we can get those questions out. All right, so our speaker tonight is Don Landis, Don L. from, is it Bloomingham? Bloomingham, Washington, am I saying that right? I'm way off, aren't I?
Bellingham.
Bellingham. I was close. I'm going off memory.
No, that was awesome, dude. That was like the worst I've ever heard, and I really like it. Bloomingham. I like that.
I was thinking Bloomingdale's. Bellingham, yeah. Washington. So I'm not going to take up any more of your time. We're done with all the housekeeping early on. I'll pass it over to you, Don. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. I'm Don Landis from Bloomingham, Washington, and I'm an alcoholic. If you can hear me, somebody give me a thumbs up. I think you can. We're connecting. Wonderful. We're all here. Happy Sunday. I hope everybody's had a good weekend and is enjoying their sobriety today. I want to thank, I won't thank him. He's not here. So I'll thank Larry for the kind introduction. No, I'm kidding, David. Thank you for the lovely invitation to come and participate in your fine meeting and interesting format. I like that. We're going to talk a little bit and then we're going to answer some questions. We'll see how that goes. I want to tell you a little bit about myself, get some of the particulars out of the way. I live in Bellingham, Washington. That's about 100 miles north of Seattle, about 20 miles south of the Canadian border. We're like British Columbia south right there, and America's first defense against Canada, I suppose. And it's a lovely town. It's in the Pacific Northwest. It's exactly what you'd think of. You know, we're right next to a beautiful bay, and we've got a snow-capped Cascade Mountain in the distance about an hour from my house, and it's 150-foot trees and rivers and lakes, and it's it rains a lot. You know, we kind of earn our stripes, and during the winter, you got to hide the cutlery, and we lead the nation in suicide attempts and successes. And there's a reason for that. It's a little dark and dreary in the winter, and then spring comes and everybody remembers why we live here. And we're just getting into that part of the year where everything's starting to bloom and the temperatures are going up and the sun's coming out. And we're like, oh yeah, that's why I live here. But February, you want to find out what kind of a sober alcoholic you are, stay sober in Bellingham in February. You'll really start to understand. And I'm sober since September 16th, 1991. That puts me at the 29-year mark. I have a home group. It's the SOS Men's Group. We meet on Monday and Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock at St. James Church in the Fairhaven District of Bellingham on 14th Street. And 3 weeks ago, we started meeting face-to-face on Wednesdays. We're still we're doing that hybrid for the foreseeable future because not all of us are comfortable coming back yet for various reasons. And we have a lot of friends from different parts of the country that attend. So we're trying to experiment and see how that goes. Mondays, we're still meeting virtually at our book study because we don't have a space large enough to hold us. And that's an interesting transition as we go back to the brick and mortar world of AA, so to speak. And I have a sponsor. His name is Vin Kay. He's over 40 years sober. And the most important thing I can tell you about my sponsor is he's completely unimpressed with me. And that's my prayer for you. I hope your sponsor is unimpressed with you in every way they can be unimpressed. What a wonderful asset I have in my corner is a guy that's willing to tell me the truth as he sees it about me. And we're very good friends. You know, we've known each other forever. He's only been sponsoring me about 6 years. And, you know, it was an interesting experiment. We were afraid maybe it would affect our friendship, but seemingly we're able to separate the sponsorship relationship from the friendship relationship. And he is, I wouldn't say brutally, but he's directly honest with me. And I appreciate that. And anyone that's been sober, has long-term sobriety, knows the danger. There's so many gifts about being sober a long time, but there's dangers too, you know. And one of the things is people assume you're okay all the time. I mean, my God, I'm 29 years sober. I should have the hang of this. You know, I shouldn't have any problems in my life. I should know what to do. And that's very misinformed. You know, I'm as alcoholic as the day I got here. I'd like to think I act a little bit differently. And I would think that I have spiritual tools at my disposal that I use frequently. But it's still a one day at a time program for me. And I can get off the beam in every way you can get off the beam. One day at a time if I'm not careful. So to have that asset, that strong sponsorship in my corner is incredibly important for me. And I have no legitimate reason or explanation for why I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, but besides the fact I'm alcoholic, and I didn't even know that for a long time. Now I have a story, as we all do, and I have a story of, you know, my family of origin and my childhood and things like that. And the truth of the matter is, you know, I've got one of those stories that if I tell it just right, hopefully somebody listening will feel sorry for me. And that was always my intention when I told that story, you know, and it's about growing up without a father who deserted the family and growing up in poverty in a tough neighborhood and my mom's alcoholism and the physical abuse. I mean, you can see it just rolls off of my tongue like an old familiar song. And there's a reason for that. Because by the time I got to AA at age 31, I had been telling that story for so long as my explanation for a poorly lived life that my perception, my reality, my truth, if you say it long enough, it becomes true for you. But the problem is it's an incomplete story. It's not inaccurate, but it's shot through with omission. Because if you're an alcoholic slash victim like I am, if you're a guy that will find any reason to defend his right to drink, then you're going to use your childhood, your bad breaks, your misunderstandings, whatever you can grasp to. And behind all of that is an alcoholic who can't stop drinking. Behind all of that is a guy that the booze is very important to. And if I'm going to keep drinking in light of the way that I live my life and treat other people and in light of the consequence that the drinking brings into my life, it better not be my fault. Because if it's my fault, I might have to do something about that. And you know what? The drinking's too valuable. So I'm grateful that I came to AA and I got a sponsor, and I got, like many of us do, dragged through the steps, kicking and screaming, absolutely sure. What does this have to do with staying sober? And I got to the inventory process in steps 4 and 5. And I simply wrote down in black and white what really happened. And it was shocking, the things I forgot on my way to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I wrote about that tough childhood, you know, and I found out 2 very interesting things. By the time I was done, I realized that I had been afforded every opportunity to excel at the game of life any young man could have been afforded, that I had been surrounded by people that loved me, encouraged me, and supported me my entire life. And whatever reason I ended up in AA more dead than alive had nothing to do with family or environment. Now, those things may color my story and my personality, but they have nothing to do with why I ended up in AA. The other important thing I found out about my childhood, which was shocking, was it's over. Remember when you found that out? I had no idea, because I was walking so hand in hand with it on a daily basis, you know, clinging to that old story about how it really wasn't my fault. That when you finally figure out, oh my God, you know, the monster lives in the mirror. I'm the architect of my life. I'm the guy that drove the vehicle into my life, into that wall again and again and again. And you start to realize that why you ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous is very unimportant. And what is of supreme importance is what you have to do to stay here. And so I'm grateful for that strong sponsorship and correcting the only mistake that a loving God ever made in my life. And many of us have this mistake, you know, that, you know, I don't know about you, but God made my eyes looking outward instead of inward. And where you're concerned, the world is concerned, what's wrong with things? I have a natural ability to look out at the world and the people in it and instantaneously, intuitively, with no effort on my part, tell you what you're doing wrong, because I instantaneously know what you should be doing instead. And I love to share that because I'm a giver, you know, I'm a helper of people. And, but where my own life is concerned, you know, where the quality of my life is based on the quality of my actions, I'm a blind man in the wilderness, absolutely no ability to look at myself. And I don't think that's unique, you know, which is why when we call up our sponsors, we're rarely talking about what we did. You know, I've been sponsoring people since I was 6 months sober, and I've been sponsored in AA from my second night. You know, why is it that we talk so much about what they're doing to us and so little about what we're doing to them? And I think it's the way that I am naturally, my natural inclination, without divine intervention, without directed thinking, I will always look out at the world and see what's wrong with the picture rather than what's right with the picture. And what I've discovered in my sobriety is my mind is an interesting mechanism. It doesn't just take pictures. It takes enhanced pictures. It takes magnified pictures. Whatever I put my focus on with my mind, and Dr. Paul talked about this in his story in the Big Book. And Dr. Paul called it his magic magnifying mind. And I love that, because whatever I focus on gets bigger. And that's just a natural thing that happens with me. So obviously, if I get up in the morning and my thinking is undirected and I focus on what's wrong with it all day long, guess what happens by the end of the day? I've had a bad day. But that very same day, if I make a spiritual commitment, make it a spiritual piece of business, if you will, that I'm going to focus on what's right with the picture, I have a wonderful day. Because what I find in each day of my life is a lot of ugliness and a lot of beauty. It's really interesting, isn't it? There's everything in the world contained in one simple day. And what AA suggests that we do is we focus on what's right and what's beautiful if we want to be purposeful, if we want to have a good day. And these are all things that you have to destroy your life and almost die to get to AA to be taught. Isn't that something? It's the price of admission, you know? It's like, I'm so grateful I got this information. I just wish there was an easier way to access it than to have to almost die and come to AA. And it didn't start out that way. I mean, I'm a real alcoholic. Let's be clear about that. I love the booze. I got no hard feelings about the booze. Alcohol saved my sanity until I made it to you. That's the truth. And that's an important thing that new people need to know about us. We're not reformers. We're not evangelists. We don't demonize alcohol. And sometimes that's confusing because we talk and tell our stories. And, you know, a lot of us have stories where we took a beating out there. You know what I mean? We took a whooping and we can sound like we're mad at alcohol. And that, I'm not, man. I love the booze. And it was a lot of fun for a long time. And here's why. I mean, I've heard men and women tell their story forever, right? And we all talk about getting drunk for the first time, don't we? And I know that I talk about getting drunk for the first time at 17, not my first drink by a long shot, but you know, the first time I got enough booze on board in one setting to get there, you know, because alcohol, as much as anything, it transports me. It takes me to the land of I don't care. And I want to live there. I want my mail delivered there. You know, I love the sense of ease and comfort that comes when I drink. And when I'm 17 and I get drunk for the first time, my story sounds the same as a lot of us. You know, I felt 10 feet tall. I felt smarter. I felt funnier. I felt tougher. I felt more confident. And we tell these stories as though it was fantasy or a delusion, as though it didn't really exist. And I'm not sure. I mean, the big book boldly states that every man and woman is blessed with certain skills, aptitudes, and abilities. We'll call those our gifts from God. These are the things about myself I've always known I'm good at, right? Just naturally good at them. Didn't have to work at it. It was given to me. And everybody's got their own special set of gifts. Some of us can just draw, right? You know, people like that, they can just draw. And some people can sing. It's crazy. They never had a voice lesson. They can just sing. And some people are just funny. They're just funny. You don't know what. We all get a certain set of gifts. What are those gifts, your birthright, your gifts from God? Always felt that they were just outside of your grasp. You suspected they were there, but you couldn't interchange with them with any kind of consistency or accuracy. Something in AA we like to call potential. And then something as powerful as alcohol comes into my life. And let me tell you what, I get drunk. And it's not fantasy and it's not delusion. Those gifts are right in the fist. You know what I mean? And I can fully grasp them. And, you know, for the first time in my life, that invisible wall between, you know, that wall that they can't see, but you can feel, the wall comes down. And you know what? It, like I said, it's not fantasy. It's not delusion. You put a couple of drinks in me at 17, I am funnier and I am stronger and I am more confident. And I am better looking, damn it. And I am more of, I am a better version of myself. And it's not any more complicated than this. I like the version of myself with a couple of drinks in me better than the version of myself sober. Doesn't need to be any more complicated than that. And here's the thing. If we could have stopped the story there, I'd have never come to Alcoholics Anonymous. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. And I got the physical aspect of our disease, that phenomenon of craving, that abnormal allergic reaction where one's too many and a thousand's not enough. And if you put alcohol in my system, it lights a fuse and we don't know when that fuse is going to go off. But we know one thing, we're not going to stop drinking until we get the job done. And I was like that at 17. You know, I drank to get drunk from the beginning. I don't know any other reason to drink. And here's the deal. In the doctor's opinion, we refer to it as an abnormal allergic reaction. Well, you would think that this abnormal allergic reaction would have the common decency to come with some side effect that warns me, but it doesn't. You see, my drinking feels absolutely normal to me. You know, my drinking is not confusing and baffling to me. You know, it may be confusing and baffling to my girlfriend, my employer, my landlord, my friends, society as a whole, but in my body, it feels complete. You know what? Who's drinking is confusing and baffling to me? Other people's drinking. You know what I'm talking about. It's 11 o'clock at night. You're in the bar, right? You got there at 5 o'clock. You now have an investment of time, energy, and money, and it's just getting good. You know what I mean? You've met some guys. You're become quick lifelong friends. You're making business deals. You know, the waitress you weren't interested in when you walked in now has potential, and it's all about to get really, really good, you know? And suddenly some guy that you're drinking with looks at his watch, stands up and goes, wow, I had no idea it was getting so late. I have to work tomorrow. And he goes home. You see, that's confusing and baffling to me. But my drinking, I've never taken a drink and felt it was the wrong time, the wrong amount for the wrong reason. It has always felt necessary and accurate. So I've got a disease that wants to kill me, a malady, an illness, whatever you want to call it. I got it, right? It wants to kill me. Yet it's sending me messages that there's nothing wrong with me. There's something wrong with other people. The only disease you have that tells you you don't have it, where the symptoms mask themselves. Because alongside this is this relief. In the doctor's opinion, it says, you know, men and women drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. And that is so true. That's for all men and women. But what I didn't realize is 90% of the people on the planet aren't getting the effect that I get. That alcohol doesn't have the ability to almost instantaneously change their view of reality. I didn't understand that 90% of people don't get that. I didn't understand that they don't get the physical reaction to it, because I didn't even know that I was having an abnormal reaction to alcohol. And I love that effect, you know, and the effect, in a word, is relief from how I feel when I'm sober. And I don't know that. And what happens as I go along and I drink is, like most of us, trouble enters my story. You know, because the early part of my drinking, you know, I'm not standing in courtrooms. I don't have my mom in front of me crying her eyes out going, don't you know you're killing yourself? I don't have girlfriends hiding in closets because they're afraid I'm going to tear the apartment apart again in another drunken rage. You can label all those things yet to be added to my story when I'm early in my drinking. And if you had told me I was going to end up being one of those guys, I would have said, no way, I wasn't raised that way. But it's the progression of not just the alcoholism, but the behavior that goes with it. You know, we cross these lines. And when we cross them the first time, we're mortified. I can't believe I did that. I'll never do that again. But you cross them the fifth or sixth time, it just becomes Tuesday. You know what I mean? It's just the way my alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Because as trouble comes into my story, my alcoholism keeps pace with consequence, with the two best friends a drinking drunk ever had, right? Justification and rationalization. And what that looks like for me is I got to be able to go to jail. And when I get out, right, to face the people that love me the most and want the best things in the world for me, I got to be able to look them in the eye with a smile on my face and in a laughing manner go, well, everybody goes to jail once in a while. No, they don't. No, they don't. I'm telling you. It's shocking how many people I've met since I've been sober that have never been to jail. I stopped asking. It was embarrassing. Our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And I don't know, I'm living, not just I'm drinking abnormally, I'm living abnormally. By the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was living the kind of life that if you put a normal, healthy, mature adult into my life for half a day, they'd have gone running down the street in terror. But for me, it's Tuesday. It's Friday night. It's Monday morning. Remember Monday morning? The oops, I did it again morning, where you went into the weekend with such high hopes it's going to be different this time. And you wake up Monday and the sun's shining like God's own flashlight. And you realize you did it again. All the promises and all the hearts broken again. And you can live that way, not for a week or a month or a year. You can live that way for a decade. I know, because I did it. I know everything there is to know about powerlessness. And if you're like me, eventually consequence gets your attention. And here's where it starts to be a problem. You know, I got sober when I was 31. I started to try to stop drinking on my own, every human resource I could think of, when I was 25. And what started was an odyssey for me until I made it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, doing all the things we talk about in chapter 3, various vain attempts to control and enjoy my drinking, brief periods of recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse, a feeling I was regaining control to find out I had lost even more control. And what's behind all of that? And one of the reasons that I couldn't get sober under my own power, and I wouldn't have got sober in AA if I hadn't got rid of this old idea, is, you see, I've been brainwashed by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And many of us are. And we got to get over this brainwashing, or we're going to die going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and our disease will take us out. And the brainwashing, interestingly enough, is carried out by the people that love me. Isn't that something? People that don't understand alcoholism any more than I do, right? I'm out there drinking myself to death, and I don't even understand what I'm in the grips of. I'm underestimating what's really got me. So how in the world is my family or my girl or the people that love me going to help me? But they brainwashed me, and they do it the way that they talk to all of us. We've all had those well-meaning people in our life, doctors and lawyers and district attorneys and, you know, and talking to us about our drinking. And what do they say? You're a great guy. Oh, you got a lot of potential. You know, you could probably be anything you wanted to be if you just quit drinking. You could go anywhere you wanted to go if you just quit drinking. You'd be so happy if you just quit drinking. And I lay my experience against that. And what do I see? Went to jail. I was drinking. Smacked that guy. I was drinking. Blew up the job. I was drinking. Blew up the relationship. I was drinking. Yeah. It makes sense to me. And it's easy for me to identify whiskey is the culprit. It's that damn whiskey. If I only didn't drink, I know everything would be wonderful because I'm a wonderful human being. Just ask me. I just drink too much. And by identifying whiskey as the culprit, I miss the real power of alcoholism, right? Because nobody has an adequate explanation for this. How come if whiskey's my problem, the drinking, as you say, how come if you promise me how happy I'll be if I just quit drinking? How come? Somewhere between day two and day five, the color starts to drip out of the picture and my world starts to become gray and boring and dull and irritating. How come if whiskey or alcohol is the culprit, somewhere between day two and day five, a little voice in my head pops up that sounds a lot like me and it says one word and one word only, and that's the beginning of the end. I enter a period of negotiation with the first drink when I hear this. And what the word is forever. You're going to feel this way forever. And let me tell you what, if sobriety is nothing more than a gray world that's colorless and irritating, I'm drinking tonight, aren't I? I can only take that kind of pain for so long before my head figures out that if this is what sobriety is all about, what the hell's the point? And I reach for the drink again. And it's explained perfectly in the doctor's opinion what happens to me between day two and day five. It's different periods for a lot of us, but somewhere between day two and day five, it says, I will be rendered into a state of irritable, restless, and discontent nature, right? The biggest understatement in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because when you read it in the big book, it doesn't sound half bad. It sounds almost clinical, irritable, restless, and discontent. Can you imagine I show up at a meeting and Larry's there and Larry goes, Donnie, how you doing tonight? I go, well, Larry, to be honest, I am a tad bit irritable, restless, and discontent. What's Larry going to say? Oh, no, click your heels three times. Say the third step prayer. You'll be fine. But it doesn't feel that way, does it? Right? I'm irritable. I want to hurt you. I'm restless. Maybe I'll go over there. Nope, I don't like them. Maybe I'll go over there. Nope, they don't like me. Maybe I'll get some ice cream. God, I'm getting fat. You know, it doesn't matter. I'm restless. Doesn't matter what I'm doing, who I'm doing it with, when I'm doing it. It's the wrong thing with the wrong people at the wrong time. I can't find my place in the world and I'm discontent. And if you would ask me when I came to AA what kills guys like me, I would have said whiskey and car crashes. And today I say discontent. Trust me, you ever hear I went back to the grinder, I went back to the drinking game, you better believe that I was discontent for a long time before that happened, because that is the lash. That's the mechanism. That's the vehicle. That's the delivery system that takes guys like me back to the grinder after I've been sober. It's living day after day after day in a sober state, discontent. And I finally come to the conclusion of this is what sobriety's like, what's the point? So important that we understand what takes us back to the drink. What do you think I miss going to jail? You think I miss the taste of whiskey? No, I can't get the relief from what goes around in my head in a sober state. That is my natural state sober without divine intervention, without the spiritual tools we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am irritable, restless, and discontent, and it ain't no way to live. And it takes me back to the drink over and over again. But I don't know that. So I'm drinking in ignorance, and I'm trying to stop drinking in ignorance. And when you do that, you're bringing a knife to a gunfight. You're overmatched. And if you do that over and over again, if there's one more attempt and one more failure, one more attempt and one more failure, maybe what will happen to you is what happened to me. And I lost the battle. I lost the will to fight. I surrendered. And I didn't surrender to what we ask our new friends to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I made the alcoholic surrender, you know, where I just couldn't fight it one more time. And I remember thinking, I'm a drunk. Some people are. I would have never thought that'd be my lot in life. And I just gave up ever being sober. And that was a couple of years before I got to AA. And I started making my life safer. You know, I used to say my life got smaller, but the truth is my life doesn't get smaller. My life is my life, right? It feels like it gets smaller because of all the things I have to get rid of to accommodate the expansion of my alcoholism. And I get rid of good jobs, and I get rid of my family, and I get rid of driving, and I get rid of being in relation. I get rid of anything that gets in the way where I'm going to, you know, anything that gets in the way of that drink. And I'm trying to stay out of trouble, and I'm trying not to, you know, go to jail. And that. And it's amazing. You can make your life as safe as possible to accommodate your alcoholism, and you'll find out you can still get to a lower bottom, that every bottom has a trap door. I learned not to say, God, it can't get any worse, because it always can get worse. It was shocking, you know, and I would try to quit. You know, I'd go to jail, or I'd blow something up. There'd be some big catastrophe in my life. And I'd go, this has to stop. I can't go on. And I'd gather all my strength. And I find I had a complete inability to stop. My human resources, as marshaled by my will, failed utterly. When I read that in the big book, I knew exactly what Bill Wilson was talking about, because I had tried so hard. Now, if you love a guy like me, you're my mother, my sister, my girl, and you watch me quit drinking just to drink again, to quit drinking just to drink again, to quit drinking just because we don't do this alone. We take people on this wild ride because people love us. And if you experience that with me enough times, you're going to come to one of two conclusions. One, I'm a liar. You know what I mean? And you know, nothing could be further from the truth. Every time I quit drinking, I was telling the truth. I meant it. I just didn't understand that there's no room for the truth where alcoholism is played out. You know what I mean? The power of choice has been lost, and I don't know it. So I don't have the power to fulfill the obligation of the promise. And the other conclusion you might come to is, well, he's really not trying. If he really wanted to quit, he'd quit, for God's sakes, you know, not trying. You're kidding, right? Who tried harder than we did? Don't you know I wake up every day and it's in the room with me, that thought, not tonight, God, please not tonight. Don't you know I have a front row seat for the destruction of my life? Do you think I wanted my life to turn out this way, to look this way, to experience it this way? Do you think I was ready? I tried with everything I had. My people around me lost faith in me. My people around me thought I wasn't trying. My people around me who loved me got dragged on this ride with me called alcoholism. And that is the state I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous in. And we call it hopeless. And it's the perfect word to describe how I arrived in AA. There's a lot of different adjectives you can throw around. But I was hopeless. I knew it wasn't going to get any better. I didn't come to AA thinking I was going to quit drinking. You see, the good news about Alcoholics Anonymous is it does not work because of the alcoholic. It works in spite of the alcoholic. Let's be clear. If the raw material I bring to the game of recovery is going to have anything to do with a successful outcome, I am a dead man. Because what do I bring to AA? What raw material do I bring to you good people that you can work with, right? Except what? Fierce misunderstanding, fierce resentment, a belly full of fear, and a whole briefcase full of old ideas. Not a lot of any value to work with, right? But that's how I walk into AA. Here's the other good news. The worse you are, the more we like you. Isn't that something? It's ridiculous. You know, nobody said to me, oh my God, you know, I'm sorry, but you stayed in the water too long. You know, we work really well. This is beyond us. I don't know where this. And here's the thing about AA. We're the last house on the block. Do you know there are no referrals from AA? If you get to AA, you're at the last house on the block. We don't refer you. We don't say, I'm sorry, we can't help you. Try over here. There's nowhere to go after AA. And that's because Alcoholics Anonymous specializes in guys like me. We're in the saving lives business, right? We work with hopeless, helpless, hapless drunks that have lost all hope. And that's how I arrived in AA. And even in spite of that, in spite of how wonderful AA is, in spite of how bad my condition was, because I come in here and I got the loser's resume, you know what I mean? In spite of all that, I was not going to stay in AA. I mean, my second night in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was leaving to go get drunk. And I wasn't leaving because AA doesn't work or God doesn't exist or the steps aren't a miracle. You see, we all need to understand this when the new man or new woman comes in. I had lost the power of choice where drink is concerned. You see, I'm going to go drink because I don't have a choice. It's not that I'm a bad person, and it's not that I didn't come here to get help. It's just that I don't have a choice. And when I was coming up on 48 hours without a drink of alcohol, the same thing happens to me when I come up on 48 hours of drink alcohol. My head starts talking to me. And I remember sitting in a place called the Simi Valley Alano Club in Southern California, surrounded by good people like you that all seem to know each other. And like you all went to high school together and you're speaking this strange language one day at a time. Easy does it, expected a miracle. I don't know what the hell is going on, right? I'm detoxing out of my brain sitting there in an AA clubhouse with my head talking to me. You know, 6'5", 280 pounds, wearing my sunglasses at night, arms folded across my chest, daring you to come talk to me. And I'm dangerous, right? I'm dangerous because I'm terrified. Anybody terrified is dangerous. And you were leaving me alone, which you should have, right? And my head's looking at you leaving me alone. And I'm thinking, what am I doing here? You know? And my head starts talking to me going, Donnie, why do you do this? Why do you do this to us? You quit drinking. You take the pain for what? 2 days, 5 days, even a month. Remember that time you didn't drink for a month? And then what do? We got drunk anyway. You know you're going to get drunk. You always get drunk. We always drink again. Why don't we get out of here and get a drink? What are you doing with this AA thing? Are you kidding me? You're going to go get drunk anyway. Let's get out of here. Let's go get a drink. Let's go. And my head won't shut up. And I'm going to leave AA and get drunk. And it's going to cost me everything, right? It's going to cost me my place of residence where I'm living at my older sister's house, the last relative on the planet that'll have anything to do with me. You know, the last person that'll take my call, and that's where I'm living. And it's probably going to end up costing me my life, right? Let's be clear about that. And which is no big deal because, you know, I'll do anything to make the madness in my head stop for a couple of hours. And it's the most important moment of my life. You know, whether I live or die is going to be decided in the next few minutes. And I caught a break because over in the corner were two good members of Alcoholics Anonymous named Lou and Mark. And although it's the most important moment of my life for Lou and Mark, it was Tuesday. You know what I mean? And these guys were where they were every Tuesday night between the 6 o'clock and the 8 o'clock meeting at the Simi Valley Alano Club. They hung out together. They drank that bad AA coffee, told those good AA war stories. But most importantly, they had their eyes trained on the room and they had their eyes trained on the door. And they were looking for men to 12 step. And they took what I believe is the most important action we'll ever take in AA. These two good men walked 30 feet across an AA clubhouse to cordially welcome a man to Alcoholics Anonymous who was dying from the disease of alcoholism. And they did it in the kind, unassuming manner that we do in AA. Hi, my name's Lou. This is Mark. We don't think we've met you. Why don't you come sit with us? We'll get you a cup of coffee. Let me tell you, that stuff saves lives. And the reason I believe that, it might have been 30 feet for Lou and Mark, but for me, it's a million miles, right? Don't you know what I've done, who I've hurt, where I've been? Don't you understand? I can't get my eyes off of my shoes. What, you expect me to go shake hands, introduce myself, ask for help? Let me tell you, if you're waiting for me to ask for help, you're going to have a long wait. It ain't going to happen. I got nothing in the tank. My scorecard reads zero, man. I've been broken, right? I got broken on the wheel of alcoholism, and I'm dying in front of your eyes. And you're going to have to carry the message to this alcoholic who still suffers. And they knew that. Thank God. They had recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. They were sufficiently armed with facts about themselves. They had had the change of heart and mind. They had found a new power, and they couldn't wait to help the next guy. And that's who came into my life. And I sat down with Lou and Mark, and Lou hit me right in the middle of the back. I remember this. He clapped me in the back a little too hard, I remember thinking. And he said, Don, this is Mark. Mark's going to be your sponsor. And then he got up and walked away, right? And they assigned me my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that's not really done, but in my case, good idea. You know what I mean? Because I'd have never picked the weenie boy they assigned to me, right? Because Mark was everything I wasn't, you know, bald head, wire rim glasses, sleight of frame, quiet voice. And ooh, he loved God. You know what I mean? That stuff you hear in AA, I don't talk to the new man or new woman about God till they get their feet underneath him. He didn't get that memo. I mean, first time I met my first sponsor, he was telling me about God did for him, what God did for her, what God was going to do for me. He's expecting a miracle. And you know what he was armed with? Spiritual enthusiasm. God, man, that is the blade, right? That's the sword. It cuts through everything that the new man or new woman has, right? Cuts through my prejudice, my old ideas, my fear, my anger, that spiritual enthusiasm. You want to deny it, but man, when there's someone standing in front of you and they've had that psychic change and you know they don't want nothing from you, they just want you to know about it. They want you to know it's available to you. You can feel that desire to help comes with no strings attached, and it cuts through all that stuff. And I started listening to this man from the beginning, and trust me, I ain't a listener. I started taking actions that he asked me to take, and that ain't me. I'm a nonconformist. You say go left, I go right. You say stand up, I sit down. You ask me to do something, I ask you why kind of guy. And suddenly, for no apparent reason, I started to listen to this man and take actions I didn't believe in yet. And I think the magic behind that was the identification. You see, he told me about his drinking. He told me what drinking did for him, and he told me what drinking did to him. He talked about what brought him to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he talked about what he found here. And when he told his story, he told my story. I identified with enough of it to know he had been where I'd been and felt the way I was feeling, but he wasn't feeling that way that day, that he had found a way out. And so it bought me some time, and I started to do what he started to do. You know, it's interesting. That's my second night of recovery. And at my feet were laid all the spiritual tools of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't know how to use them. Not only did I not know how to use them, I saw no value in them. But I think about what I got on my second night. And what did I get? Well, I got an active member as a sponsor, which meant what? I'd be active if I'm willing to have it. He had a home group, so I'd have a home group if I'm willing to have it. He was in the literature in the big book, which means I'd be in the literature in the big book if I'm willing to have it. He had commitments in AA that he wouldn't break for anybody. That kind of non-negotiability about his recovery, which I would have that non-negotiability if I'm willing to have it. He had a zillion friends, man. He knew all of you, right? Which meant I would have a zillion friends because I didn't understand. When you get a sponsor, you inherit all their friends. Now, I want to be clear that when you're new, this does not feel like an asset. What it feels like is there's a lot of strangers up in your business. But think about it this way. I'm at the low point of my existence, right? Nobody wants to have anything to do with me. I've burned every bridge. And this new group of people come into my life and in very short time find out everything there is to know about me, good and bad. Yet they still love me and accept me. Where do you get that kind of compassion on the planet if you're an alcoholic, except a magic place called Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And if you ask me today at 29 years, Don, what are you excited about? You know, what are you so happy about your membership in AA? I go, hey, man, I got a sponsor, right? I'm transparent with him. He's the biggest asset I have in AA. I got a home group. You know, that's the place on a weekly basis. I draw a line in the sand and I make a stand for my life. I'm in the big book in the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous, holds me in good stead, keeps me in the steps, working this design for living in my day-to-day living. I have commitments in AA that I approach with an air of non-negotiability. You know, I have everything that's important in my program today was given to me on my second night in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a simple program, but it demands consistency. Doesn't demand perfection, but it demands consistency. We seem to put great value on seeking and trying. I seek God and I try to the best of my ability to live this way of life. And it doesn't matter how many mistakes I make. And how do I know that? Because I've made a lot of mistakes in my sobriety. But I get a sponsor and he takes me through all three sides of the triangle simultaneously, right? Unity, service, and recovery. Never telling me that's what he's doing. Because in AA, we don't order people around and we don't dominate. What we do is we commence our journey, our common journey, shoulder to shoulder with the new man or the new woman. And we use the ancient spiritual principle of the invitation to bring people into our way of life. And my sponsor simply invited me into his already vibrant, active AA life. He would say things like, Don, tomorrow night, I got to show up early and set up this meeting. I could really use your help. Can you show up early? And I would think, wow, man, he needs my help. That's kind of cool. And I'd show up early and I'd help him set up a meeting. Then he'd shake my hand. He goes, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. And it gave me, it left me with some dignity. It gave me a little self-esteem of the right kind. You know, it gave me a feeling that maybe I had a little bit left in the tank. Maybe there was a little life left in me yet. If you want to know what gave me hope when I was hopeless, it was that you let me play with you. You invited me to the party. You included me. You see, you were living examples of what it says in the big book. It says the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, and inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding. We believe it's available to all men. You see, you were a demonstration of that because you invited me to your meetings. You invited me to coffee. You invited me in your car. You invited me into your homes. You invited me into your friendships. You said, come with us. We know the way out. And we want you to be a part of it. We don't want you to miss it. And so because I worked the steps, I had to clean up all, you know, and I had that good resume. You know, I'm living at my sister's house because, you know, that's where the tough guys go. When the going gets tough, we go home, right? So I'm living there. I haven't worked in a year, haven't had a valid driver's license in 10 years. I got warrants for my arrest in two counties. My sponsor, when he heard that, went, oh, you're an overachiever. You know, it's like he was laughing by the time he heard about all my wreckage. Oh, you owe the IRS 80 grand. Good for you. You know, oh, you live at your sister's. That's lovely. Oh, you don't have a car. Who needs a car? The worse you are, the better we like you. But the funny thing is, you know, my sponsor never let me feel bad about what was wrong with my life. But at the same time, He never tried to tell me it was okay. He never said, there, now that you're in AA, it's all going to work out, sugar. He never did that. He used to say things like, oh, no, you have a terrible life. Terrible life. He goes, Don, I write a gratitude list every night, and you're on it. I write down, and God, thank you that I'm not Don. And then he'd laugh and laugh and laugh. He found out I owed the IRS 80 grand, and I've looked it up. That's 1991 dollars, right? That's like 157,000 now, which is no big deal. If you got a $500,000 in the bank, write the check. But when you ain't worked in a year and you finally go back to work and you're making minimum wage with taxes taken out, you're working construction, you've never worked with your hands, they have a nickname for you on the job site, right? The bleeder. You're not really thrilled about that money you owe, you know? You write that first check for $100 to the IRS and you think, oh good, 79,900 to go. And my sponsor never let me feel bad about it. He laughed at me until I could laugh about it. And why is that? Is it because he didn't have compassion? No, man, he's one of the most compassionate guys I'd ever met. We have compassion in AA, but we know there's a propulsion system for untreated alcoholism. We talk about it in the third step in the big book. It says we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, and self-pity. You see, self-pity kills drunks, right? Poor me, poor me, pour me another drink. And my sponsor knew that. We won't tolerate self-pity in AA because we know it kills drunks, right? So my sponsor took everything about me and he put it into service in AA. God, for my first couple of years, if any new guy was whining about his little $1,000 IRS debt, my sponsor would say, hold that thought, Jimmy. Hey, Don, you got a minute? And I'd walk over all innocently and he'd go, Don, tell Jimmy how much you owe the IRS. And I'd look at Jimmy, I'd go, I owe the IRS $80,000. And Jimmy would say, Jesus. And my sponsor would laugh. Jimmy would feel better and I'd be of service. And I learned to laugh at my trouble. And I realized that that stuff I was all worried about, the warrants, the money, the employment, that's not the hard stuff when you get sober. That turns out to be the easy stuff. You stay sober one day at a time, all that stuff seems to work out because you're showing up in your life and you're present. And you got a sponsor and you got a home group and you got people that care about you. There's no trouble you can bring to AA that we haven't seen before. The hard stuff, staying sober one day at a time. You know, and I remember being 6, 7, 8 years sober, you know, and laying there in bed at night doing the spiritual math and thinking to myself, wow, you know what? I've gotten out of trouble. I'm active in AA. I sponsor a bunch of people. I'm in a big home group. That's going really well. You know, I've become a homeowner. I've been returned to the world. I'm a citizen again. I vote in elections. It's amazing. I got a career. I got a profession. I'm doing well there. Money's good. I'm blessed. I got a beautiful woman sleeping next to me. That's my wife. I can't even believe how lucky I am. God, if it was any better, I'd go in the backyard and I'd hang myself, right? You know, and it's a funny thing about having, you know, climbing the ladder of success and sobriety and finding out your ladder's on the wrong wall. Because you know what alcoholics do really well? We do better. We do this better than anybody. We do wrong really well. Give me something that's wrong. Give me a bad medical diagnosis. Give me a reversal of fortune. Give me a broken heart. Give me something to point to where I can go, that's why I'm screwed up. But you know what makes guys like me crazy? When there's nothing wrong, but I feel like something's wrong. And I know what it's like to have this list in my mind. If all these things came to pass, then I'd be happy. And all those things came to pass. And it wasn't that it was bad. I just thought it would be a lot better. And you begin to realize this thing called alcoholism goes a lot deeper than drinking or not drinking. That there's underlying causes and conditions. And there's a spiritual malady. And the spiritual malady must be overcome. That spiritual progress always precedes material progress. And I got that screwed up. I thought that those things that society tells me, if I have them, I'll be okay, meant that I'd be okay. And they may work for other people, but they don't work for a drunk of my kind. And I should have known it. Because before I got to AA, you know, I was the boy wonder. I was 23 years old with a secretary in 2 offices, hiring and firing a crew of 100 people. I had arrived. I made an obscene amount of money. I was very successful. And you know what? It didn't stop me from drinking and it didn't stop the wind from blowing through my gut when I was sober. I should have known it. And I forgot that. I got seduced. I thought that if I had enough of this, that, and the other thing, if my life looked a certain way, then I'd be okay. And I found out that spiritual malady doesn't care about any of that stuff. And alcoholism doesn't care. And I had to go back through the steps with a different emphasis, which was I had to leave the land of make-believe with this power that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to really answer the question that we get asked in We Agnostics. I thought I had answered it, but I had not in a deep enough level. You know, God is everything or else he's nothing. What's our decision? Do I believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself? You know, I had to answer those questions on a different level at 6, 7, 8 years sober. And I had to continue answering them. What does my relationship with this power really mean? What order? And, you know, I came to the conclusion, after doing it the way many of us do it, right? It's like, because I'd love to tell you I surrendered. I love it when you hear somebody talk at AA and they go, and then I had my second surrender. Like there's only 2. God, wouldn't that be nice? I wish there was only 2. I don't know. I've lost track of how many times I've had to surrender in 29 years because I get off the beam. I slide into self-will like a comfortable pair of shoes. doesn't make a sound, and it feels natural. And if I stay there long enough, I wake up one day and I can't figure out why I'm all screwed up, and yet there's nothing wrong in my life. You know, I think the muscle of alcoholism, this thing we talk about, irritable, restless, and discontent, that's available to me anytime I want to run on self-will long enough, you know. And what we find out, here's a better way to talk about untreated alcoholism for me. This is how it shows up in my life. I have a complete inability to experience joy in a sober state. And how many times has there been nothing wrong in my life, but I feel like something's wrong? Like I'm trying to figure out how to make myself happy. And I forget the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous, the St. Francis prayer, that whole altruistic idea that if I want to be happy, I got to make you happy. If I want to feel fulfilled, I got to help you be fulfilled. You know, if I want to feel hopeful, give somebody else hope. It all starts by going away from me, not to me. And I forget that. And so I've made those mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's the real point I'm trying to make is every good thing in my life, everything that I can say, I've really changed in this area or this thing or that thing, whatever it may be. There's always a component in that change. And that's that I had to be wrong. I had to first be wrong about something I thought I was right about, because only then can I go to God with a real humility and understand where I'm missing the mark. You know, because to this moment, I've never worked on a problem I don't have. Have you? You know, you ever do a 10-step and go, look at that. My side of the street is completely clean, but I think I'll talk to God about it anyway. We don't do that. It's these things that we label negatively as failure, being wrong. Turns out those are the catalysts. That's the fuel for change. I can't change unless I think I've failed or I'm wrong. And now, you know, the worst thing in the world when I'm new is being wrong, right? You go to your sponsor when you're new and your sponsor goes, that's okay, kid, you're just wrong. And you want to punch him in the head. You want to defend yourself. And now when I figure out I'm wrong about something, I get excited because now I know I'm about to change. Can't change without being wrong. So you learn that your values change in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so through all this, the good news is you can be perfectly imperfect and still stay sober. You know, so I'm sitting here now, I'm 60 years old, and you know, I've had a good run. You know, I've had a good sober life in Alcoholics Anonymous, man. 29 years sober. It's a large enough experience in life that I've got that experience where I've been through some stuff. And I've experienced every joy you can experience, every accolade, every success, every wonderful. I've had all of it, but because it's a well-rounded experience, I've had every heartache, every failure, every fear, every challenge, every financial reversal and marriage problems and sex problems and money problems. And I've had a human experience and I've been present for all of it. But through it all, I came to you people. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I tried to be as transparent and honest as possible. Good, bad, happy, or sad. And you have never thrown me away. And you've always said things to me that meant the world to me, like this. You would say, yeah, me too. Isn't that something? It's the death of loneliness when you come to AA and you're with your fellows and you're sharing something you feel so bad about that you did, said, or thought. And they say, yeah, me too. And suddenly you're not alone in your humanity. And you realize you're not a defective mistake, that you're just another one of God's kids doing the best you can on this blue marble, but you're not alone. And so we continue to work this way of life. We continue to expand what? Our relationship, because that's all you get. It seems inadequate as a reward for all the work we're asked to do in AA, right? What do you get for working the steps and all this other, you know, happy horse shit, right? What do you get? Well, you get a spiritual awakening. What? You know, that's it? Yeah, that's it. But you find out that's the most valuable thing you'll ever get in your life. It's the keys of the kingdom because you get a relationship with the power. And because you have a relationship with the power, you have the honor and privilege of asking one question and one question only, but with nothing between you and the answer. And if you're spiritually fit, you'll really want the answer because you're going to take action on it. And it's the key to the universe for guys like me. Guys like you, right? What's the question? What would God have me do? And if I can live my life along that simple line, what would God have me do? And take action on it, guess what's going to happen? Happy, joyous, and free. And I'd love to tell you that the answer I get from God is the answer I want. A lot of times it's not, because most of the answers I want are about me. You know what I mean? God a lot of times gives me answers about you. Isn't that funny that it hasn't changed? Where God is always pushing me into helping one of you, which it turns out is the best I'll ever feel. I discovered it early in sobriety. You know when I feel the best? When I'm not thinking about me and I'm thinking about you. That hasn't changed. But my ego hates it. Hates it. So I come back to AA and I come back to people like you on a daily basis so I can be what? Reminded of what we're supposed to be here. So we get to stay sober together. I understand that. And I always feel better when I'm with you. I'm at my best when I'm with my fellows in Alcoholics Anonymous. It used to make me crazy because I'm a thinker, right? I don't know if you identify with that. I want to know why things work and why they don't work. I used to go to meetings and go, why do I feel so much better after I go to a meeting? I mean, what is it? It's not what's being said. That's the same old AA dribble. It's not the people. They're not that remarkable. But I'd feel better after I was with you. And then one day I'm reading We Agnostics with a new guy, right? We get to the part in the book where it says, inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, right? Maybe obscured by pomp, circumstance, worship of other things. But in the final analysis, it's only there that he can be found. And the guy's having this trouble wrapping his head around the idea of God. What does he mean by that? I go, well, think of it this way. How about light of God? Like inside every one of us is a little divine spark. We carry a little light of God, every one of us. And it hit me that when I'm out there in the world, I've got my divine light, that little spark of God, but it's mine. And I go and I'm out there in the real world, you know, slaying dragons, whatever. Right. But when I come to AA, guess what? You're all there and you bring your light and I bring my light. And when we come together, sometimes it's so bright in that room, I can barely see. And you know what I'm talking about because you have felt it. You know what it's like to sit in AA. You don't have to say nothing and you don't even have to listen. You can feel the room and you can feel God and you can't deny it. You see, when I'm with you, I'm better because there's so much God in the room. I just feel it on a level. I never will feel it when I'm alone. But when I'm with you, I don't just feel my God. I feel your God. So I'm better with you. So I don't fight it. I keep coming back to you. I hope I always come back to you. And I hope we stay sober forever. And I'm going to stop it right there. Thank you.
Wow, Don, thank you so, so much. I'm going to give everybody a quick opportunity to unmute if you'd like to and just thank Don real quick.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Don, so much.
Thank you so much. That was awesome.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was the best.
All right. I'm going to steal it back. Yes, Don, thank you so much. We're going to give Don a quick, some time to take a break, do some housekeeping, and then I'm going to pass it over to David because David's back. Now we're going to pass around the virtual Seventh Tradition basket. I'm going to put a link in the chat where you can donate. The Seventh Tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. And while contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seventh Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Quick reminder, please, I need your questions for Don. I got a few, but I appreciate some more, so please send them over to me. A quick word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcome environment in which our meetings can take place. I'll now open it up. Let me allow people to unmute again, and I'll take a few AA-related announcements. Does anybody have an announcement? Feel free to unmute. And Morgan, I see your hand.
I'm Morgan. I'm an alcoholic. Tomorrow night, this home group, Simple Actions, is having supper and a speaker. Obviously, we won't be eating face-to-face like we normally would be, but feel free to grab a dish, hop on Zoom. We're going to have speaker Jack D from Baltimore. That's at 7 p.m. tomorrow. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks, Morgan. Ebony.
Hey, y'all. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony. On April the 28th at 7 p.m., District 14 is hosting our concepts workshop. We have 12 concepts, 12 traditions, and 12 steps. If you don't know what the concepts are, neither do I. Welcome to the club. It's a great opportunity to have someone who's involved in the service structure share their experience with the concept. This month, fourth month, we'll be talking about concept four. We'll have our past state delegate, Michaeleen, speaking. And then she'll speak for about 20 minutes, take a quick break, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers as well. Hope to see you there. It's April the 28th at 7 p.m. Thanks.
Thanks, Ebony. Any other AA-related announcements? Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining Simple Actions or you need a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Can all home group members please raise your hand? Awesome. Speaking of sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have a question or you'd like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available after the meeting. Usually a few people will stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. If you're shy or you have some additional questions, you can send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All right, that's it for me. I'm going to now pass it off to David. David's going to take over and answer some questions. Once again, if you got a question, please send them my way, and we'll make sure we get them to Don. All right, David, it's all yours.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is David. Simple Actions is my home group. I'm grateful to be sober and grateful to be here tonight. Larry, thank you for chairing. Don, thank you so much for coming to share with us tonight. It was just amazing. I listened in the car on the way in, and I don't know why I want to cover this again, but I was just struck by this very simple statement. I realized this amazing thing about my childhood. It's over. And it just spoke right to my heart. And rather than try to interpret that, it just seemed like the beginning of being open to maybe I'm the problem. I just want to bring that up again. Is there any more in there to pick out on that? I just thought it was a great point.
Well, you know, David, the thing you got to understand is like my outstanding, the juggernaut resentment I have, the Genesis resentment, and usually all of us have one, this one that's the big one. It's usually our mother, or our father, you know, somebody that was really close to us when we were young. In my case, it was my father. When I was 2 years old, he went out for a pack of cigarettes. We never saw him again, never sent a dime of support. As though he tried to erase this mistake he made in his life and had insult to injury, he went back to his hometown, married his high school sweetheart, had three other kids, and seemingly got it right the second time. So growing up, this resentment, having no way to deal with it, no information about it, it festers. And as I become, you know, I'm an alcoholic because of what alcohol does in my body. But as my life goes on and as my life isn't turning out the way I want, the resentment starts to become valuable. And what it is, it turns into this explanation. And that resentment colors my perception of life. And I really, it's looking back, because life is understood backward and lived forward. But looking back, I can see how that resentment made all the other ones possible. And what you end up with is this idea that life isn't fair and it's not in the cards for you. And most importantly, if you're an alcoholic, it's really not your fault. And so this inability to take responsibility, and one of the things in AA that, you know, good sponsorship will get you to do is you understand that no one's trying to tell me that my dad was a good guy. No one's trying to tell me that I didn't grow up in poverty. Nobody's trying to tell me that my mom's alcoholism wasn't tough and I saw things at a young age no young boy should have seen. Nobody's saying that. What we're asking you to do is set that stuff aside. Not that it didn't happen, just set it aside for a minute. It's right there, it's safe. You can pick it up if you choose to when you're done. But let's talk about you. Let's talk about what you did. Let's talk about how you treat God's kids. And it's not about you break away from the bondage of that relationship enough to look at the way that you've lived your life and you've treated God's kids. The best analogy I ever got for getting, because in the first three columns in inventory, right, we're looking at column one, who am I pissed off at? My dad. Column two, what's the cause? Well, he left and never looked back. Column three, what does it affect? My whole damn life, right? So now, but I've been writing those first three columns my entire life. I don't need AA for that. I'm just learning to put it down on paper. Column four is new, because disregarding the wrongdoings of others, I resolutely look for my own mistakes. Where was I selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, or afraid? That's all new. So I look at this stuff and it's a whole new ball game. And what I do, Bob D from Vegas talks about this. In the first three columns, I'm at the prosecution table, right? I got the perpetrator. I got the crimes committed. I've got what the damages were. After the first three columns, before I write the fourth column, I got to get up and walk over to the defense table. And what I'm trying to do is put myself in that person's position. And that's why there's spiritual preparation that we do, the directions in the book, before we can even think about writing a fourth column and finding what's on our side of the street, is we have to have a change of heart. And it takes spiritual preparation. You know, I'm praying to God to give me something I don't have. What does it say I have to pray for? The same attitude I would cheerfully grant a sick friend, right? Patience, tolerance, and pity. I don't have that. Prayer is a form of asking for God for something I don't have naturally without him. So before I can even think about looking for my mistakes or my wrongdoings, I have to have a change of heart about that hatred. I have to see and get to a place where I actually, and this is hard, identify on some level with the person I'm so angry at. Have I ever been guilty of deserting somebody? Have I ever let somebody down? Have I ever walked away and not looked back? Have I ever left somebody holding the bag? All of these questions that I had to ask myself about my father's behavior, I realized I'd been guilty of all those behaviors. And so I'm judging him for being me. And understanding why he did what he did when he did it became less important than understanding why I was doing what I was doing so I could stop it. I could come to God and talk about my character defects rather than my father's. And that shift is brought about by something that we value highly in AA. It's called empathy. It's called compassion. It's called identification. And we're never asking anybody. Some of us have horrible, and I've got some of them, horrible things that happened to us in our childhood. We're not telling you it didn't happen. There's a big word in inventory in AA, and the word is value. You know, we're going to start to give ourselves permission for the first time to ascertain the value of these resentments in our life. And what I discovered is they had no value. They were hurting me, never helping me. And I, you know, some of this stuff we get over simply because we just get tired of being a slave to it. We get tired of being imprisoned by it. We want to get free. And I realize I can never get free unless I let you off the hook. And by letting my father off the hook, by forgiving him, by praying for him, by making amends to him, right, for my former ill feelings, I thought I was letting him off the hook. I'm the guy that got off the hook. You know, I can't, I can't love and hate in the same space. And I can't want forgiveness. You know, that's such an important part of the Lord's Prayer, where I ask God to forgive me my trespasses, but only to the extent I'm willing to forgive others their trespasses. That's the equalness, the fairness of the equation. I need to be forgiven. You see, if I do you wrong, David, I want forgiveness, empathy, and understanding. But if you do me wrong, I want revenge and retribution, right? It's like there's two different types of wrongs. AA gets us to get over that. Wrong is wrong. And we've been as wrong as the people we're angry at. Once we can see that, we can forgive, because we need to be forgiven. That's a long-ass answer to a good question. Thanks.
Right on. When you first came in, how were the concepts of powerlessness and unmanageability presented to you? And has your understanding evolved or changed on those two things? And maybe how do you help men that you work with today kind of grasp that?
Well, interestingly enough, I think the powerlessness is pretty easy for most of us. We understand that we're powerless. And here's the way it unfurls for most of us in recovery. We come in and we got no problem saying we're powerless over alcohol and those other substances. We got no problem with it. We give that up. We did all our research. All the votes have been counted. I get it, right? The idea that we're powerless over other things is a process of elimination. And what we're eliminating is the folly, the falsehood that our human power works in these other areas of our life. And we don't give that up through success. We don't give that up through reading it in a book or having a sponsor tell us. We give it up through good old fashioned failure. Failure of what? Our human resources. So what a guy like me does is go, yeah, I'm powerless over alcohol. You got it. All that other stuff. You bet. I can't stay away with it without God's help. Why not? Sure. I'm able to swallow all that, but my business life, my sex life, my money life, all that stuff. Yeah. You know, let's be real. You got to take care of number one. No one's going to do it for you. So the idea that we're going to trust those God. So basically I'll trust God with my drinking and that's it. But my set, you know, God can make a butterfly, but my sex life's pretty important. God can make a baby smile, but my money's kind of important. You know what I mean? You know, I shortchange the power of God. And what's behind that is fear. It's the abyss of the third step. You know, your sponsor walks you off to the edge and goes, jump. And you look down and see nothing. And you go, you jump, right? And he goes, I already did, right? And that's the abyss that we jump into, the spiritual way of life. What will happen to me? And I don't get to those conclusions through success. It's just through running on self-will, getting broken in half by untreated alcoholism, sober in AA, going to meetings, being sponsored, blah, 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 where I go, I'm not doing this very well. Maybe I should try what those AA people are really talking about and stop, you know, doing this dog and pony show of spirituality and really act like I've turned my will and life over to the care of God. And you start to live in the spirit of the third and the seventh step, which is, if I really believe that I've turned my will and life over to the care of God, then it's not my business. And you begin to live your life as though God is management and you are labor. You just want to know what to do next. You just want to serve. And if you can get closer to that, you start to find that you can face life successfully. And you start to realize the easier, softer way is a spiritual way of living. But that's the powerless side of it. The unmanageability is you come to AA with a low bottom like mine, and you'll tell people about it, and they'll say to you, pretty unmanageable, huh, kid? And they're wrong. That's not the unmanageability we're talking about. Here's the unmanageability, and it's really explained in A Vision for You when they talk about what drives people back to drinking, right? Where it says a problem drinker being dry at the moment says, don't miss it at all, work better, feel better, having a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we laugh at such a sally. We know our man is fooling himself. He's like a little boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He would do anything to take a half a dozen drinks and get away with it. He will try the old game again because he's presently not happy with his sobriety. He will come a time in his life where he cannot imagine life with alcohol. Then will come a time in his life where he can't imagine his life without alcohol. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. That's the unmanageability. If this is your menu, right? I can't drink anymore because I get in trouble and it tears the skin off of my life. And it's so painful. I hate who I've become. I just can't drink anymore. I can't not drink because the pain of sobriety makes me absolutely insane in my own mind. Well, if you're an alcoholic and you've hit a place where you can't drink anymore and drinking tears your life apart, welcome to unmanageability. And you take the alcohol out of that equation. That's the alcohol consuming portion of unmanageability. You take that out and the unmanageability that we're left with in sober alcoholism is left to my own devices, a life run on self-propulsion will always be a failure because I will always be in collision with somebody or something. And we begin to realize that when Bill Wilson wrote selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble, and went on to explain we have to get rid of self or else it kills us. What we should ask next is, well, how the hell does selfishness kill me? Okay, I admit I'm selfish. Okay, great. How in the world is that going to kill me? Here's how. If you live in a selfish manner, we call it self-propulsion. You will constantly be in collision with somebody or something. If you have a life full of collision, you'll have a life full of pain. If you're in pain long enough, you'll think that sobriety is painful, and you will never fully lose the remembrance of what makes the big hurt go away. You will try the desperate experiment of the first drink again, and for us to drink is to die. The way our selfishness kills us is it walks us hand in hand, slowly back towards the first drink, whispering, there, there, it's okay. It's really not your fault. Come on. I know it'll make you feel better. And we go back to the very thing that was killing us, the very thing that was ripping the skin off. And we watch it on a regular basis in AA. We watch people make good beginnings. We watch their societal lives get better. Families reassemble, back in the big bed, making good money, showing up to the meeting in a nice car. And then we watch them go drink and die. Why is that? Because they were living by self-propulsion, and that collision was painful. Always in collision with somebody or something. So unmanageability is my life run by myself will always be painful, and that pain will eventually drive me back to drinking. My life, and that's hard, man. Let me tell you, of all the things my ego doesn't like, that's number one on the hit parade. Number one, that my life run on by myself will always be a failure. Oh, and you see, when I think of failure, I think of money. I'm a man. So I will immediately talk about my career or my possessions as a defense against that. That's not the failure we're talking about. Here's the failure. If you ain't happy, joyous, and free, it's a failure. Oh, well, that's a different conversation, isn't it? Right? So we start to change our value about things. I hope that's helpful.
That was great. And there's a thread running through all of this stuff, and you you said it very explicitly toward the end, and I never quite heard it that way before. So I'm super grateful for it. But this idea that the catalyst for change is failure, is mistakes, is being wrong, and you know, having an environment in Alcoholics Anonymous where we can freely admit that stuff, and rather than being like, oh, how's that working for you, Don? Yeah, me too, Don. I did that too. I thought that too. I felt that way too. I'm right there with you. Yeah, I don't have a question. I just, it bowled me over.
Oh, good. We're glad you're bold.
We're built on failure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank God. You said you started sponsoring people 6 months sober. Mm-hmm. How will I know when I'm ready to sponsor others?
When somebody's standing in front of you because your sponsor has insisted that you extend yourself, your sponsor will see you talking to your buddies in AA, and he'll walk up and interrupt your conversation and go, why don't you stop sucking the life out of the room and go say hi to that new guy standing over there by himself? And so your sponsor will force you to start talking to other people that you don't want to talk to. And it'll piss you off, but you'll want him off your back because his will is stronger than yours. And then one day somebody will say, will you sponsor me? That's how it begins. But you don't get asked to be sponsored if you ain't talking to new guys if you're a girl talking to new girls. So you first have to put yourself out there. And here's what happened to me. I went on a 12-step call. I met a guy. I was with a guy with 14 years and another guy with 6 months. We 12-stepped this guy. He was still drinking when we left. He called me the next day, asked where the meeting was. I told him where the meeting was, met him at the meeting. He asked me to sponsor him. I told him I'd get right back to him. Found my sponsor, said, hey, that guy asked me to sponsor him from the 12-step call. He said, what did you say? Well, I told him I'd get right back to him. He said, let me get this straight. He was drinking his brains out last night. I go, yeah. and somehow he made it to AA today? Yeah. And he took whatever strength he had left and asked you for help? Yeah. And you told him you'd get back to him? Yeah. Go say yes, you selfish bastard. That's how I became a sponsor. Now, I'm 6 months sober. I'm living at my sister's house. I don't have a car yet. I'm working construction for minimum wage. I'm hopelessly in debt. If you want what I have and you're willing to go to any length for it, and that was my opinion of it, how the hell could I possibly sponsor somebody, right? My sponsor, I said, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't want to kill him. He goes, oh, you got to kill a couple before you get the hang of it. You know, because everything's a joke in AA. Everything's very funny. And I'm serious, man. I don't want to hurt this guy. I forgot that I'm not the well. I'm the pipe. Doesn't matter. What I do is very unimportant. God will work through me. You see, it's not of me. It's through me. I'm just the guy with the pleasure and the privilege of watching the resurrection of another human being's life. The minute I forget that, my ego's in charge. And that's a crappy sponsor, by the way, when he forgets that God is supposed to be God sponsors the guy. I'm just the human form, right? Not the well, I'm the pipe. I found out this guy, who, by the way, is still sober today, just has 6 months less than I do, right? Talked to him a month ago. He's doing good. Anyway, that's not because of me. That's because he took the actions in AA. But I found out he didn't care that I lived at my sister's house. When he got a year in the program, I asked him, I said, his name's Donnie. I go, Donnie, you could have asked anybody for help. Why in the world did you ask me? And he goes, well, you told me your story. I go, yeah. He goes, yeah, I figured if a loser like you could get sober, it'd be a snap for a guy like me. So you never know what beneficial message you carry to the newcomer. You see, God's going to use you. And I'll tell you another thing. Once I figured out you had to help people work with others to stay sober, I said to my sponsor, how will I know who to help? And he laughed. He said, Don, God made you. He knows everything about you. Therefore, he knows you're not very bright. The people you're supposed to help, he's going to put them right in front of you so you can't miss them. And what an amazing idea that is. What if we all got up in the morning and we operated under this principle? Whoever is standing in front of me there today is there by divine appointment. They were placed there by the Creator in that moment of time for no other reason than for me to be of service to them. Now, what kind of world do you think we'd live in if everyone on the planet got up and played that spiritual game? But I don't speak for the world and I don't speak for the people in it, but I speak for myself. The days I get up where I decide that everyone that's in front of me is there by divine appointment, and my job is to try to help them, that's a good day, man. That's a good day every day. But I forget it. You know, I forget that stuff, you know. But that is how I started. And that's when you start sponsoring. Read the history of AA. You know, it's like people got sober, worked the first three steps on their first day of recovery, were able to go and join the rest of the guys and girls, right? Started doing the rest of their steps simultaneously while they started carrying the message. It was a two-step program, really, you know, when it started. I mean, we had 12 steps once the book was out and but it was really a two-step program, which is surrender, help others. Those were really our unspoken steps. You know, and if you talk to people in AA with like 55 years of sobriety today, and you ask them what's changed, they'll go, well, to be honest with you, we did a lot of book work. He said, we did a ton of 12-step work because they found that nothing reduced your self-centeredness more than working with somebody else, right? You can write inventory till the cows come home. We all know that inventory at a certain point just becomes self-obsession. So they knew in the beginning to get out of self and help others is how you reduce your self-centeredness. So when are you ready to start sponsoring? The pamphlet, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship, says that you should have a year of sobriety and be through the 12 steps. Now, I'm going to tell you something that never comes up in my talk because it doesn't really matter, but it's interesting. My first sponsor had 6 months when he started sponsoring me. My first sponsee, I had 6 months when I started sponsoring him. I came from a line of people at the end of that line was a grand sponsor with 30 years of sobriety. So all the direction was the same coming down, but we believed in working with others. And we believe that it shouldn't be one guy sponsoring 20 people. We believe everybody should be sponsoring somebody. Everybody should be taking somebody through the book. You know, I know the book, but I should. You know how many guys I've taken through it? Every time I take a guy through the book, I have no idea what it did for him, but I know what it did for me every time. So the real gift, we sponsor to stay sober, not to get people sober. That's between them and God. I sponsor to stay sober. Anything I add to that, that's ego.
Thank you. We are, we're out of time. Will you tolerate one more question?
Sure.
Because this is, this sounds like help. The quote is, the worse you are, the better we like you.
Yeah.
And the comment is, I have a lot of guilt, shame, and remorse over my past actions. How do I get over that?
There's no shortcuts. And I'm going to try to be as honest with you. So please also understand what I'm about to say comes from experience and love. Right? I was racked with guilt, shame, and remorse when I got sober. I couldn't sleep at night. I would literally physically flail in bed and my brain wouldn't shut up. I'd go, oh God, I remember when I did that. Oh God, I wish I hadn't have done that. Oh, fifth grade, you know what I mean? It was just a horror show every night. Things that I had pushed down with all that whiskey all bubbled up to the top in sobriety. And the truth was I hadn't lived a purposeful life and I hadn't lived a principled life and I'd hurt a lot of people. And I didn't, it was so much pain. There seemed to be no way to ever get any relief from what I was feeling about it. But here's the truth. You get over your guilt, shame, and remorse a little bit one day at a time. The first thing you do is you start to live a purposeful life in AA. You're helpful. You set up meetings, you clean up meetings, you show up early, you stay late, you talk to other alcoholics, you try to help where you can. And you start moving from the negative column of life to the positive column just by trying to be helpful. Then you work the steps as you do this. When you get to the steps, you go in the amends process and you try to make these things right. You go back to the people you caused harm to. And it's a process of discovery. We think we go and make these amends with this preconceived idea. We don't. We make appointments. We give people, we create an environment of safety where people can tell us the truth about how we affected them. Because we're going by what we think, you know, how I hurt you, how bad I hurt you, how long you should be pissed off, what it should take for you to get over it. I'm wrong about all that. I'm going to need their participation. How did my behavior affect you? What can I do, you think, to make it right? And then I start taking actions to make it right. Right? And I find out in that process just how bad it was and how I really hurt people. You know, because I come to AA, the only person I hurt was me, right? And then you find out, oh no, who'd you... I said to my sponsor, who would I make amends to? He goes, I don't know. Who did you know? You know, it's a funny joke, but it's pretty accurate, right? So the two solutions for the guilt, shame, and remorse is think of a scale, a balance scale. And when you get sober, the scale is weighted down with pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, the wreckage of your past, all those things you did you can't believe you did. And the other side is empty. That's your good action and your good manner of living, right? And you start to slowly put little grains of sand in the right side. And slowly, over a period of time, depending how hard you work, the scale starts to tip. But it never becomes like this. You know, a good friend of mine in sobriety says that when they die, they want on their tombstone. She says, she gave more than she took. She goes, and I'm going to have to work really hard to the end of my life for that to be true. I never want to forget my past. I never want to shut the door on it. What I want is it to become valuable experience for me and for others. But I don't want to ever forget the way that I lived. I can think about things I did before I got sober to this day, and they'll make me cringe. And I hope they always make me cringe. I hope I'm never okay with the manner of living that at moments, the way I acted. But I'll tell you what allows me to be happy, joyous, and free today isn't that God waved the magic wand and took the pain. It's I've lived a purposeful life, and there's a lot of good action, a lot of altruistic action, a lot of living the way I think God would have me live that has balanced the scales to where a guy like me says it hasn't been all bad. But that takes time. But why you're getting well, why you're walking through those feelings of guilt, shame, and remorse, the best thing you can do is be active, active, active in the program and fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It served me well when I went to AA on a nightly basis, just feeling so bad about myself. But I could set up meetings. I could put out literature. I could listen politely when people share it. I could shake hands after the meeting. I could get to know, I could be a part of and feel like, yeah, my life's horrible and I lived a terrible life. But you know, today, just today, I'm doing what I can for my recovery. That's what we do. We take what we got that day and we bring it to the game of recovery. Some days we have more than others. But that in the beginning, when that stuff's choking us out, you got to start balancing the scales. And I don't know of anything better than to be active in AA. Thanks.
Thank you, Don. I'm sorry we're out of time. I've been looking forward to this all week. Everybody will get the opportunity to thank Don again after the Lord's Prayer. Thank everybody who showed up tonight and participated. Larry, you're a godsend. And I wonder if I could ask our dear Debbie to read a vision for you.
Sure. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Debbie. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you all for a wonderful meeting. How about we virtually circle up? Feel free to unmute. Let's have a confusing, static, written version of the Lord's Prayer all together.
Yeah.
Moment of silence.
Moment of silence.
Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us.
And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen. Thanks, Don. You're so generous.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
That was one of the best.